hidden character.
Oh, Elise Fioso!
That was a healthy pour. Ladies and gentlemen, happy fucking happy hour. Michael McShane is here. Michael McShane, a nice Italian fella, is here. Michael McShane's in the house.
Grand to be here in the unlimited bucket of Chardonnay.
He doesn't drink.
Oh, Jesus.
Here's, instead of bringing down the whole bottle, I just did a very healthy pour. Mm-hmm.
She's drinking for both of us, and I gotta appreciate that. And, you know, in the spirit of me ruined liver and me cauterized kidneys, I got a fantastic idea, Stephanie. And the rose of Trelawney that you are.
Exactly. Like a pregnant mother is eating for two. I am drinking for two, Michael McShane.
To make your
you are
pregnant,
disgraced to your homeland, sir.
You know, it's great. I get away with it because I'm adopted. I'm not even Irish.
Michael McShane, you are, okay, you are one of our improv beloveds. You came to us through Rick Overton.
I love that applause.
You
are like there's like mice under the desk on crack.
Right. Yeah, exactly. It's fake radio applause,
I like
Michael.
It. I like it.
Enjoy
it. I love you so much. We decorated Snow White's house.
You are part of our improv beloved family. You came to us from Rick Overton. You're a friend of Robin Williams. You did the British Whose Line Is It Anyway? What? How did you become Britain's favorite son? What the fuck happened? You came from Boston.
No. Then the great.
What, did we trade you for a draft pick? What happened?
No, I came from Kansas City. Sean and I just hooked up on the whole Kansas City connection.
Kansas City.
Yeah. I got to change that somewhere. Yeah, somebody said Boston and
You weren't born in Boston?
No, I was born in Marquette, Michigan. I was adopted up into the Holy Family Orphanage in Marquette, Michigan, which is now used as an extensive set for horror films.
So you're part of the Holy Family.
The Unholy Family. 100% haram.
So wait a minute. So where? Okay, you were born in where now, Michigan? How did you end? And when did you end up in Kansas?
When I was 3 weeks old, I was David Lewis for 3 weeks and having a grand time in the Holy Family Orphanage, and the McShanes picked me up when I was 3 weeks old. I auditioned well, and they brought me to Kansas City where
did they make you do an Irish voice?
They didn't. They didn't actually. I did a good hot 5 minutes, some topical stuff about I always bring in the tits, do blue when you're talking to expectant mothers.
Manly, yes, I like it too.
And the nuns, punted me out, and there I was in Kansas City.
Wow.
So Kansas is the first thing you remember.
Kansas is the first thing I remember. Okay. The first thing I remember.
You're not in Kansas anymore. Just, you know.
No, I'm
just
not.
Just for shits and giggles. Just please, telling you. Okay. What is the matter with Kansas?
Kansas is fantastic, even though Frank Morgan had to be drunk to the entire Wizard of Oz to get through it. Did you know that he was hosed during the entire show?
I did not.
Yes. His actual name is Wupperman. And his family, the Morgan family, who's, I think his other brother was the president of Screen Actors Guild, his family were one of the inheritors of the ingredients of the Angostura Bitters fortune, which is divided between three families.
That's like an old man drink, Bitters.
Bitters. Well, it goes into so many
things.
What
the fuck's in that? Oh, really?
It's herbs and, I don't know, Muscovado sugar and beetle guts.
That's your AA sponsor calling just to make sure that I didn't get you off the wagon.
Talk you down here. Come, Mike. But I just had he's part of the Gilded Age. He's a Gatsby era guy.
Right.
And he used to show up to work every day with a bottle of champagne. And he was like, they called him like 3 o'clock Morgan.
Right.
So he was like that famous Hollywood tradition of like Broderick Crawford. Get him before 3 p.m. After that, he's got his pants off and he's on the roof.
All right. So tell us the most fantastic, weirdest resume I've ever seen. So you did the British version of Whose Line Is It Anyway?
Yeah.
You're an improvisational genius, sir.
Well, I'm part of a bunch of old Tyrannosaurus improvisers with Proops and...
Like Proops and Overton, Rick Overton, and Overton. All my beloveds.
God love them.
Yes.
It was Greg and a guy named Brian Loman got me to improvise at San Francisco. We all went to college together, majoring in cannabis studies and bumping into shit.
Uh-huh. Where'd you go?
San Francisco State.
Oh.
Communist Progressive School.
Mm-hmm.
Cranking out little Marxists for over 75 years.
You majored in communist cannabis.
Yeah, like communist and cannabism. Yeah. And so we went into the Bay Area theater and comedy system in the 80s, which was, really rolling along quite a bit, thanks to Robin Williams. and
who you were very close to.
No, I was not.
Oh, I know you were.
I've worked with him, and he gave me and Greg one of the greatest strolls in our life. We played the other cafe. Did you ever play the other?
No,
up in the Bay Area?
I've never been outside my basement.
That's
this is it. Exactly. Pretty much it. If you don't come here and talk to me,
wow, it's the set.
You don't
list,
know me.
It's the set list of Anne Frank, and it's like meat, more dick jokes.
Anne Frank, but not Jewish, and hopefully it ends better. But
it is
anyway.
Better.
Go ahead.
She gets laid, you know.
This is horribly inappropriate. Go ahead, Michael.
No, so
and I'm in the basement, not in the attic.
Yeah.
So Jesus Christ,
well,
Michael, that that is so offensive that you would apply him in my attic.
You know, she might have made if it had been in the basement. So we're all from the Bay Area, and then they hit all the improv towns,
mm-hmm.
The producers, right? L.A., New York,
what the fuck is it with San Francisco? Why did all the, Robin and you and Greg and Rick, and what was with San Francisco in particular about improv?
I got this thing about, when I go to the U.K. and people ask about theater in America, and they know New York, obviously, and Broadway. And then regional theater kind of gets the same sort of short shrift that they give their regional theater,
right.
Except for a few places that they're very proud of, like Bristol,
right.
or Sheffield. Anyway, so I think part of the spirit, like Chicago's got its own theater identity, whatever that is.
Wow, that was a little wow. Second
San Francisco,
City, suck my dick. Second City,
San Francisco is this crazy hippie, highly politically
mm-hmm.
informed.
Mm-hmm.
Colorful, balloonatic like world, you know, which
right.
you can put Robin near there, Wavy
right.
Gravy, Pickle Family Circus, San Francisco Mime Troupe. So it's usually has a left wing political inform, but it's also very, it has a vitality, a mad
right.
vitality.
Which, let me just say, all the funniest people are left wing. It's obviously.
It's, yeah, like Brooklyn gives you great, funny left wing people. I worked with Harvey Firestein. He had a whole dissertation of why
right.
Brooklyn produced so many great comedic people because of the output of immigrant and the left-wing point of view.
Right,
You sit down and talk
right
to a
right-wingers
guy
aren't funny. You know why? Because they fucking, they punch down.
Well, that is true.
Right.
I think they're across, you know, they ameliorate. You have the sort of like, the soft right, sort of like, you know, we all have crazy things about our, no, you don't, no. I'm
no,
not as
you
crazy
don't.
As you this way, no, no.
No.
But
you know what's crazy? No, that's not. No.
Oh.
So now,
it's like Mark Russell is a fascist. Here's a song.
You're like, fuck. All right.
So I left the Bay. Yeah, did the Bay Area, did Shakespeare in the Park, and did improv, and it was a great time to be there because
right.
you could afford to live there for one.
Right.
And there were all these people like Greg and everybody around there, and because you could die there and nobody cared, and you could kill there and nobody cared. It wasn't like Hollywood or New York where, you know what I'm saying?
Comedically, you mean.
Stakes-wise.
Yes, right.
Stakes-wise.
Right.
And there were like four or five theaters where you could kind of make a living if you were a single guy.
Right.
If you ran a couple seasons with them.
So wait, you grew up in Kansas.
Yeah.
You were adopted.
I was adopted.
Yeah.
Grew up in Kansas.
And what was your family like?
My mom was a farm woman from northern Kansas, became a suburbanite. My dad was a retired Army officer. And they met at a prisoner of war camp in
that's hot.
Concordia, Kansas, which
that's
held
hot.
Rommel's Africa Corps.
Wow.
Yeah, no, it was a trip, man. And my dad was like all about, the enlisted guys were great. The war was over for them, and they were really lovely people. You know?
Yeah.
Because the officers were weird. The officers would get off the train and go, and look at the American soldiers and go, soon, you know, you will be working for us. And these guys, well, these are a bunch of confident sons of bitches, aren't they? You know? And he had to meet the highest ranking Nazi officer who was
right.
in his prison. And so the guy came in, walked through the door, and they stood up to salute him because the Nazi officer outranked him. He had to salute him. And the officer went, how's it going, sport? In perfect English. My dad was like, what?
Mm.
He goes, yes, I studied at Yale.
Oh.
Yes, you'll be surprised.
I've heard of that.
You'll be surprised.
Have you heard of that, Sean?
You'll mm-hmm. be surprised. There's a lot of people at Yale who think very much like we do. And my dad was like, oh, you dirty son of a. And he was like,
you
that
dirty
was it.
Son of
so
wait,
when
how did you
Bush
get to
got,
Yale?
When Bush,
how
got, elected,
Yale?
When Bush got elected, my dad went, I guess that son of a bitch was right.
So wait, how did you get to Yale? What was your childhood like? What the
well,
fuck?
Well, no, I didn't go to Yale, but my dad was a loquacious Irish American. I
mm-hmm.
think I gained a lot, and I went to Catholic school, so you get a
yeah.
good way of saying, you know, 100 ways of lying, you know.
Right.
And so I got into that, and I was 18. I joined the Army to get out. I got enough of Kansas, right? You know,
yeah.
And joined the Army. I was in the Army for 3 years, and. I was stationed in Fort Knox, Kentucky, and then I got sent to California, to Stockton.
Oh,
that's
how
I wanted.
Glamorous.
Ooh. That's well, I thought Stockton. they said we're sending
well,
you to California.
Stockton's the gateway to Barstow.
It's, oh, man.
This thing, it?
Sure beats
it's,
Kansas.
It's oblivion. Mm-hmm. It just barely. Dude, it just barely, because I thought, man, I'm going to California. I get off the plane in Stockton. I go, shit, it's Kansas with palm trees. What the hell is this?
Fucking same.
Oh, Lord. And you have like French Camp and Manteca, which is Spanish for lard, and these towns, Ripon. I mean, it was a weird, it's like Florida with less fun and more open space to die in.
So what, how did you become a comedian? Do you have siblings? What
I happened? Wanted to be, I wanted, what? No, I'm an only what? Kid, an only kid okay. adopted. I, okay. I was lucky enough to have friends that have big families. I was like, you know,
right.
I was the chuckly fat kid that you know, until I got caught, I got sent to Osawatomie, which Shamano was a state mental institution.
Oh yeah,
like
I saw
six,
that. How, what was that? How was that?
6 fun months of. I was great. They gave me a pharmacopoeia test in the beginning.
Don't do any electroshock jokes. Oh, sorry. Don't.
I never got it. I never did it. But I used to give coffee to the adults who had received electroconvulsive therapy.
Oh, Jesus.
On the weekends,
fucking Christ.
Which the age used to call Saturday morning cartoons.
Wait, why did you get sent there?
I was kind of, you know, loud and big and scary and violent.
You were like a Trump voter.
No, I wasn't. I guess I was. You know what? If I'd stayed there and kept on, if that stuff would have happened,
right.
I probably would have felt so much like a victim all my life. Then I would have gone, I'm a victim that way.
Right.
Because I think some people vote for Trump because they says they're a white guy's pushed up against the wall by policies that he's not going to help you with.
Right.
And he makes enough squeaky noises that you hear it and you need it. And you feel ignored by people who are shown to be prettier and apparently more well-spoken than you. Not always the case. And you start to go, all right, you know what? I'll define myself by hating you. And so I'll go and do that.
Right.
You know, I will not flush the toilet of state. Right. And I'll leave a Don Draper right on the rim for you when you walk into the houses of the holy. I'm sorry. That's, you know.
I'm sorry.
There's a guy
I just backwashed Chardonnay. Okay.
Now, a Trump voter was just a couple days ago. I was like at a Starbucks and I was waiting for the bathroom and this guy opened the door up and I was hit like with a massive stank wall. He walked by me and he goes, it's all yours. And I went, you're a Trump voter because that's your philosophy. Hi, I just laid a big steaming load. Enjoy. I'm done with it.
Yep.
There we go.
Good luck. All right. So how did the whole comedy thing happen?
Well, I think I was lucky. I got Fred or Max.
Oh, it's a baby dog.
That's
a baby Fred.
Hey, Fred. I get this massive white skull. It's like having one of the wind walkers with me here.
Yes, that's right.
I was always wanted to be in do theater and stuff, and so at junior college I had a chance to do some plays. I didn't do stand up. And when I moved to San Francisco and I got into improv, the places where you got improv, you know, they share the same real estate.
Right.
I think they have a different course than that, but that's where they are, right?
Right.
So that's where I found it, and that's where I felt comfortable and had a lot of fun.
Yeah.
And I learned the disposability of ideas. And San Francisco's kind of has that thing with it.
I just can't love your resume anymore. Trivia fun facts. Grew up in Roland Park, Kansas, a bedroom community of Kansas City.
Yes. Yes, exactly. You could
like bedroom in a porn way?
Yeah, exactly. People were just fucking everywhere.
Really? Okay.
Yeah,
fantastic.
Yeah. That's because we couldn't get in our tree houses at night.
King-size actor trained in the classics and improvisational comedy in Berkeley.
Exactly. Known as Mr. Lovable Fat Bastard by his friends and Parliament Wide Cheeks by the rest of the world, he consumes over 50 times his weight in butter every day. This lovable, greasy ball of fun has brought joy to the hearts of America and fattened the arteries of the clown in state, Donald Trump.
I love this from the Telegraph. Hang on. I did a little research. America's Fat Boy Slim. God. It's been a decade since Mike McShane packed his bags and went back to live in America. After 6-year reign as the improv king, on Whose Line Is It Anyway, he still remembered with unusual affection. He recalls arriving in the city in the middle of the night. I pulled up the hotel. There was this boarded up pub having a rave. I was greeted with, hey, it's that fat cunt off the telly.
You gotta stand. This is Manchester, you know, 24-hour party people. And the plane got me in at 5 a.m. And it was these new, very hipstery flats.
Right.
They were very nice and very fortunate they let me stay there. right off this really old area, the Quay, Dean's Quay.
Mm-hmm.
And they're pubs. Pubs in the UK have these wooden doors on the sidewalk where they roll the barrels down into.
Right.
And this pub was a big old one, like an old late Victorian, three stories, like an inn. And it was closed and decrepit. Words about it, it was boarded up. Sun was just coming up. Cab drives me off, and you could hear this, like, I'm like, man, who's clubbing? And you can see the lights coming out from underneath that wooden slat in the sidewalk.
Right.
And all of a sudden, the doors flip open, and there's colored lights and shit, and these three guys crawl out like troglodytes. And I've just got my bag, and I'm just transfixed. And they crawl out, and the cold air hits one of them. They just go, wah, and just launch, you know, a cascade of vomit, which they all three look at like druids divining the guts of a sheep. And then they look up and see me, and that's when the guy in the mancunian goes, oi, what's a fat cunt off the telly? And I was like, these are my people.
You're like, hello.
I love you.
Good to be
back. I love
you.
And they were laughing.
Good to be back.
And,
I love you, Manchester. Good night.
Believe me, they can be a tough audience, man. I mean, you get
Manchester
heckles.
By the sea. That's fucking depressing, man, if you've
imagine,
seen that fucking shit.
The moment before he punches everybody, that's an audience full of those people. You know, the British have great heckles, man. One of the famous heckles was a woman yelled at this one comedian, goes, hey, I want to have your children so I can gas them.
That's fantastic.
You know, and that would take...
you know, women, we only got, like, show us your tits, like, whatever.
Nah.
Yeah, my favorite was... somebody heckled a woman comedian. Like, what are you, gay? She's like, what are you, the alternative? It's a lot, you know.
See, when you can bat him back in. I've seen, you know, masterful people like you, and Proops has batted in. Batted
Proops
in.
Is the fucking shit, man.
Oh, man, no, exactly. It's like having a Gatling gun of snark, you know, trained on you.
So wait, all right, hang on. So... You had the gastric bypass thing.
Yes, I did. Yes,
okay.
I did.
You said you were adopted by two tiny Irish-American people, and you always felt like a bit of a like a freak.
I always felt like, yeah, I felt like Baby Huey. I always wanted to come out, hey, Daddy! You know.
What is it, Huey?
Flintstone appliance animal voice. The Dawes Butler. That's a great voice at the time. You know, remember the Flintstones? I always thought they had all their appliances were creatures with these sort of slightly nasal Jewish adenoidal voices.
Boy, if she doesn't clean my beak, I'm going to be clogged up for a month.
What was her vibrator like?
So you lost another person. You lost a lot of weight.
Yes, the other person was the scared... right-wing motherfucker from the Midwest, and he's wandering. He's in a trailer somewhere named Mankato.
So
all those comedy Midwestern town names. Hi, I'm from Mankato. You certainly are, aren't you?
I love that you said in this article, I'm a celebrity with a small C in England and a silent C in Hollywood.
Thank you. Yes. That's the best way just to get to it, you know?
Right. Well, listen, we have a lot in common. In headline Edinburgh Fringe. I'm sure you heard of it. I played the nurse in Streetcar Named Desire at the Edinburgh Fringe Festival in... When was it, Sean? You know, I'm going to say 1981.
Wow, whoa. What company did you go over with?
1982. USC Theater.
Oh, Lord,
I played Lucy in A Good Man, Charlie Brown. I played the nurse in Streetcar Named Desire. Edinburgh Fringe Festival, a triumph.
Did you have a good time?
Holly in Uncommon Women and Others.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. It was probably 1982, I'm going to say.
Did you make any money?
No. It cost me
money. Fringe,
you had to pay for it.
It cost you,
It was USC to pay for the credits. I was like fucking on the stage at 3 o'clock in the morning, like painting over screws, like.
That's it. For 1 month, there's silent voices through all the overpriced flats in Edinburgh of American students going, what the fuck was I thinking?
What the fuck? What?
God damn it. Now I got chlamydia. I got Scottish chlamydia. That's even worse.
I did. I am. And I'm gay. And I met a guy in Edinburgh that I started dating. That was the whole thing. I don't know what happened.
You were off your rocker.
I didn't know I was, you know, the A gay then. But anyway, I was just like, okay.
Say, wait a second.
Wait a minute. Sure. I'll eat haggis. Goat brains. Sure. That sounds great.
Haggis?
Marry you? Yes.
Did they try to sell it to you as a delicacy? They was good. It's a Scottish delicacy.
Everything is goat brains, right?
Yeah, sheep. It's sheep plucking.
Sheep.
But this word's like, it's a Scottish. I go, no. This was made, and you made five of them, wrapped them around your shoulder, and went up into the highlands. And if you were a crap marksman, and you were going to starve to death, this is what you ate. This is like the consolation prize on Let's Make a Deal as food.
What else you got in there? Refrigerator feed? No?
Nope.
Sheep brain? All right. Okay.
Wrapped in the stomach.
Is it sheep or is it goat brain?
It's sheep. It's sheep brain, sheep lungs, which is pluck, called pluck. And thank you. Nice squirt at the end.
Yeah.
Wrapped in the caul, the stomach lining of a sheep.
Oh, so it's not goat brain.
No, goat.
It's sheep.
No, that would be weird, brain. Man.
That'd goat be weird.
No,
that'd
no,
be,
that'd be
that'd
unusual.
That'd be gross, Sean.
That'd be gross.
So wait a minute. So you did you headlined an Edinburgh Fringe thing to benefit Robin Williams.
Yes,
which
I
is
did.
Beautiful.
I was just
about mental health.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I just after my time in Osawatomie and all the stuff I saw there and the things that I got off easy and I saw people that had worse things in their lives and the way it was managed and how it's understood and you know, so yeah, it struck me as, I mean, I met him only a couple of times and he was, I have the most boring story in the world about Robin Williams.
Okay.
It's what a nice guy he is because its ubiquity makes it boring. Mm-hmm. You know, it's ubiquity from people. It was just the nicest guy in the world.
He was nice to me.
He was warm. He was open. He could have been intimidating and he was friendly to me and Greg. He played with us and let us have the lead in the improv.
Yeah.
You know, he could have walked all over us, took two of us to hold him down, you know. And afterwards, he, like, made a big deal like we were all hot shit. And Greg and I, you know, this was in the 80s. We were on the moon. We walked home together, and we thought we were the kings of the world because of him.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you and Overton and all you guys, I mean,
Overton was his buddy.
Yeah.
Overton was his
I know. No,
friend.
I know. Oh, yeah. No, he was on right after Robin's death.
Oh,
but I thought it was an interesting... This benefit was, you know, was a message of support to hard-to-reach groups such as middle-aged men.
Yeah.
Which I thought was interesting. You know, you said, I worked with Robin when we were young, and he came to see me backstage in the past, too. Any improviser my age or younger was inspired by him. So much was happening to Robin. He had Lewy body dementia, was suffering from clinical depression as well as Parkinson's. He had this triple dose of It's All Falling Apart. You could see where the story was going, you said. There'd be a day where he stepped out of the house and fell over. There'd be a camera waiting. It'd be like he's drunk or he's on drugs. Poor Robin.
Right.
You said when something tragic happens to someone who's funny or they do it to themselves, it's a ready-made tears of a clown scenario. I find that to be very limiting, especially when it comes to Robin.
Yeah.
That's a really profound, I mean, you're right. I think people didn't realize because he didn't want them to. There was a lot of stuff going on for him. It wasn't one thing.
I think, you know, the more you make something, the more you reveal about yourself, especially when their interest is prurient and you're that huge and the image of you is that open, you represented for better for us. Because, you know, remember, and, you know, there are all the critics that bagged on him in his movies because he wore his heart on his sleeve as an actor. And yet you had to acknowledge he had the technique for the most part and just purely as a performer to carry it off. If it became or seemed maudlin or sententious, it was because of the directing or the way it was sold or the way it landed with the audience.
Right.
I don't think he ever gave a cheap-ass performance.
Right.
And so that against the sort of like Tears of the Clown, the Pagliacci's syndrome, which we love to do, you know, I mean, even in our own business, I was working on something and this actress was like, oh, you're funny. You must be so sad on the inside. I go, No, I'm good. But my bra size has dropped by a point because you're boring the tits off me with that bullshit. Sorry.
But yeah. No, but everybody's different. You're right. Like there's, you know, it's no. Wait, you're married?
Yeah.
How long you been married?
I've been married 25 years.
Wow.
Yeah.
You're going to get some fake radio applause for that because
some applause.
But no, good for you. But so no, who is she? How'd you meet her? What happened? Blah. Kids?
No kids. Karen and I met in junior college in the 70s, and we went out for a little while, and then we broke up, and then she went to Hawaii, and I moved to San Francisco, And then we re-met later in the mid-80s, and which is kind of nice because we both really loved each other in the beginning, but were too young to...
Right.
Yeah, you know. And then we both left and got to figure ourselves out and then re-meet again. Bless Sean.
Bless you, sweetheart.
Bless, thank you.
Got to figure ourselves out.
Right.
And then come back. I mean, and that is a very fortunate thing.
Right.
When it comes to... I don't know if we would have gotten married if we would have stayed married when we were younger. Because that time there was like, I don't know what I wasn't, you know.
Your first time married?
Yeah.
Yeah.
The only time, yeah. I think that's the remnants of my Catholic upbringing.
Right.
I think if something happened.
No, my parents are married for 40 years till my dad died. You know, Irish Catholic, yeah.
Yeah. You know, I don't feel like it. I mean, if I got, yeah, I don't know. I don't know. I don't know what that means anymore. I would love to live with somebody. Nobody likes to be alone or lonely. But the formality of it. The roots were both were raised Catholic, Karen and I. We both have eschewed the religion for a spiritual life. And so
you never wanted to have kids? Or
no, we never wanted to have kids.
Yeah.
That's
fantastic. I applaud that.
You know, yes, we're traditional, you know.
I don't think any comedian should.
Oh, you're a barren couple. Yes, yes, we are. We live in a Victorian world. And my wife's hair is pulled back around her neck to stifle the screaming. What the fuck me?
Okay, wait a minute. So we have to talk about some fun facts about your career because it's fantastic. You have the most eclectic. You did a guest appearance on Seinfeld as Kramer's nemesis, Franklin Delano Romanowski.
Yeah.
FDR.
Yeah.
What was that?
It was really, it was a lucky bit. They wanted to do this backwards episode. And the B story was somebody put a curse on Kramer for throwing a snowball. And they brought me in, and it couldn't have been nicer. It couldn't have been more wonderful. And then they advanced the story a little more into two other episodes. So I got three episodes of it.
Wow.
And then they wanted me to come and do the final one in the courthouse.
Yeah.
But I was touring One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest in the UK, and they wouldn't let me out of the gig. Because
that fucking sucks. Fucking sucks, man.
I hated that. I mean, you know, I used to make a lot of noise about that, you know, when you first start out going, well, I would never do something like leave this thing if another thing came along.
It's Seinfeld. What's wrong with you people? I got to get out of this.
He was the best guy to audition for. He was the
Jerry?
Best.
Oh,
yes.
Yeah. Was he?
He was so nice. Yeah. You know, you can get with some comedic performers who are like, yeah, it's funny. I want to do this. Okay, good. Yeah,
very good.
But he was like, "Oh no, do that again. That's hilarious."
Fantastic.
Yeah, he was like, you know, really warm and comes. You know, I come on the set. He walks me around his set because it's his shop. He's got
right.
That's what I like. He had this guy. You know, I'm amazing people. Like when I was a kid, younger guy, I met Bill Graham.
Right.
I went to do a guy who got out of college with us became a co-assistant lighting designer for Bill Graham Productions, and he got us tickets to the Stones up close.
What?
And we were out of our tree, you know. It was in the 80s, and they were really great. It was like the Voodoo Tour. I think. But anyway,
oh, shit.
Anywho, we're walking like fourth row front. We're psyched, and this guy's putting up chairs, and he turns around. He's got like a crappy sweatband handkerchief on his, and it's Bill Graham putting up his own fucking chairs. And he looks, what, are you going to sit down or what? like an old Jewish producer said, what, you want to die of a stroke? Sit.
Sit. Sit.
Have some overpriced beer. You didn't bring anything with you, did you? No, sir, no. Okay, good.
All right.
Enjoy the show.
So wait, all right. You played a fire truck in
Robin
Hood,
Prince of
Thieves.
Fire truck.
In a small role as a doomed hypnotherapist in the 1999 film Office Space, in which you played the friendly scientist. What?
Put this wig on my head. That's one of those movies. We did it, and they said, oh, come to the premiere. It was like, you know, over at Westwood, and we got some, like, a popcorn and a Coke, and okay, we're done, now fuck off.
You're like, fuck
you know, the
off.
Crew. But we're kind of like, you know, that was actually pretty good, you know. We forgot all about it. And, you know, and then you start getting the things where you're seeing you get residuals, when you did get residuals, and all the ones for purchases. And I went, a lot of people are buying this movie. They're going out to buy it.
Right.
And I was like, interesting. And then people would stop me and recognize me, like then from Who's Line or Richie Rich or
Richie Rich the movie.
Yeah. Right. And that. I went, oh, it's because it really relates. I mean, Diedrich Bader in it is a work of art. He plays every guy in the Midwest, a guy who was your friend,
yeah.
Who's kind of a doofus, but really a good guy.
Sure. Means
you
well.
You know? Yeah, totally means well. you know, and the, you know, is great because Diedrich is very intelligent, well spoken Yankee. I mean, I think he's like a Plymouth Rock baby sort of guy, you know, like on
right,
a family line.
Right.
But, yeah, and he was just, I would still love that. It was just a perfectly composed film.
Mm-hmm. Okay, you appeared in Frasier as Frank, the manager of the Shangri-La Apartments.
Yes, I did. Yes, I did.
What is that?
It was like a five liner, one of those things. I mean, the only thing, I think the only joke in it was, I didn't try to be super ass funny because you got Kelsey there. And his joke was like, come, Niles, let's have him show us. I mean, he put his pants on and everything. That was the gag.
Okay, know? Got it.
And it was like bachelor apartment, so you go down the hall and you know, have a little people crying. And it was Niles just got a divorce. And, you know, so it was that. And that was the poshest green room of any green room.
That was the shed, right?
Man, no, it was upstairs above the set. It was this long with beautiful, like, really nice furniture. You were like, my Lord. And everybody's been on the show and they take your picture. Kelsey didn't stick around for mine. But the rest of them did, and they were very, very nice. And David Hyde Pierce was really sweet to me. I mean, yeah. I had like five or six lines. I got a couple of laughs. And when they, you know, they thin, and then David Hyde came and he goes, ladies and gentlemen, the extremely overqualified Michael McShane. It was very, very nice to me.
Well, no, because I was getting whiplash from your resume because I'm going, okay, did this stuff. And then you appeared with Sir John Gielgud, Emily Watson, in A Summer's Day Dream on BBC. So how did the British thing start? How did you become?
So I went over and did the show. The show was a hit. There's nothing like helps like right. being in a hit show. God knows, you know, and being singled out for it. And then I was. And Greg and I got, you know, a lot of like these are Americans we like sort of thing.
Right.
You know, they can,
most of them are fucking assholes like Donald Trump.
Yeah. You had to fight it because you're coming out of Bush and Thatcher. And so reactions against Americans, and especially if you're a large, white, fat American like me. Was, you know, it could be a little bit weird, but it wasn't really. And so we just kept working over there. And I moved over there because I went, shit, I'm going to see how long. And, you know, the thing is, I'm not a star. I'm not a star from America who came over. I'm not Meryl Streep coming over. I'm not, you know, John Hamm. So I'm a jobbing actor who lucked into a good show who was very popular over there. So I will play Americans. You'll never, ever, ever see an American play a Brit over there. That's not going to happen.
Right.
Because that never happens here.
I don't even know what else to pick out from your resume.
Sir John Gielgud is really nice.
Is he nice?
He was really
nice.
Did
old. He say, here's the set, walk this way, over to the set. Walk this way.
If I could walk this way,
wait,
I wouldn't need the talcum powder.
You played one of the twin pill bugs in A Bug's Life?
Yes, I know. This is... This is, yes, it's an almost damn near successful career.
It's fucking topped awesome.
Topped off by pill bugs.
You played, you appeared in Drop Dead Gorgeous, which I loved, with Kristen Dunst.
And Amy
as
Adams.
The quick-tempered beauty pageant judge.
Me and Will Sasso were brothers in that. That was a lot of fun. Very funny.
You provided the voice work for Vampire Hunter D as Bloodlust, D's sarcastic possessed left hand.
You know, that's a good thing. When you start to get into anime, you have to do those descriptions. Well, you were Lord Kumor, the giant panda with the iron fist who ruled the land of Glockmore in the Kingdom of Narnus, who was
you
also
Audrey, too, in the London revival of Little Shop of Horrors.
Yeah, man, that
you're
was
just a fucking freak, dude.
That was a great gig. Oh, God.
Oh, my God.
I was down in the west end of the basement of this theater on a mic with two monitors next to these massive wooden dowels, and what they were the dowels that rocked the ship of Captain Hook in the original J.M. Barrie production of Peter Pan.
Wow.
And, you know, the first, you know, that's like, even the rats on the West End have got theater history.
Max!
You know? Exactly.
Right,
you know, they come down.
Max is what
they
did.
I took a crap and said, like, Guinness's room. Here's a picture of me. Hello. My name's Raddy McRadrad. Eric Vermin. Hello.
See, you're one of these improv kings, voice actor extraordinaires, like
and
all of our
get,
beloveds, like
no
Rick Overton and Greg Proops. And,
I get no voice work anymore.
Why?
Because there's so many good people in this town, man.
Yeah.
It's a lot of good people in this town.
Oh, Max wants to say hello. What's my baby dog?
Look at these, like,
isn't it like Narnia?
Dinosaur-like
It's stones. Like Narnia. Yeah.
Yes, exactly.
What?
All right, wait. You appeared in Tower of Terror. a TV movie starring Gutenberg and Kristen Dunst. Based on the Disney ride Coup. What was that about?
That was my first introduction to Hollywood dynamism.
Uh-huh.
I got back from the UK. I moved to L.A.
Right.
Actually lived in Claremont because Karen was studying at the university in Claremont. And I got this gig, and I was like, this is fantastic. And Kirsten Dunst was in it, and she was just like a kid then, and Steve Guttenberg.
Right.
And so, you know, I'm in my little trailer, and we're over off of La Brea in the Hasidic neighborhoods,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I was just digging being in L.A., and it's going on a while. You know, I was like, wow, you know, I've been here a while. Nothing's happening. I don't see the camera. And finally I got the second AD, and I go, hey, what's going on? He goes, we had to stop down because they Steve Guttenberg's trailer was like a foot and a half further away from the location than Kirsten Shit. Dunst. And I was like,
What?
What? You know,
white people problems. Yeah.
Well, it's like there's a scale. There is grandeur and glamour in show business. It's all there, and there's some people are amazing. But to be frank, and after what we just said, I never saw Sir John Gielgud bitch about a foot and a half of a trailer. He ate lunch. You go up to the BBC lunchroom, and there's Judi Dench, him, I don't know, French and Saunders. The greatest. It was like a movie. It's like an old school movie studio.
Yeah, yeah.
They're all eating bad British soup, BBC cafeteria food,
which is why their teeth are so bad.
They're not anymore. They have great food. They did, you know. But the idea, they're all just, and everybody kind of leaves each other. But they're all nobody's new.
Right.
There's unfussiness to British show business. There's a side to it. There's plenty that is, but its core is like, let's just get on with it.
Right.
And I do love that about them.
Yeah, yeah,
and
yeah.
I just
hear you.
Why is that? And we did, and then, you know.
I loved on May 17th, 2013, Radio 5's breakfast show accidentally announced that Mike Michaud had died.
And that was Steve Guttenberg. He did that because I pissed him off by telling the story about him in his trailer.
Oh, really?
He's really got it in for me now.
Oh,
sugar
my
in my
God.
Gas tank. You know, I got footage
of him.
But
you had not died. They had to do a retraction.
I did not die. No, I didn't.
No, you did not.
I didn't.
I'm almost certain you
didn't. I've died twice. I've died twice on the internet.
When did you die?
There's a British performer named like Mike McCain or Mike McCanus, who I don't know, and he died, or he was like a local newscaster or something, and somebody did the Brazil thing, just misplaced a couple of letters, you know, and I got my agent calling up and going, you know, Karen, is Michael there? You know,
and like, is he there? I mean, is he there?
I mean, there.
No.
As in corporeal, standing up.
You
know? Wow. So you're a real fucking actor. You're like a fucking, like, Britain considers you an actor. You're an improv genius. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, call
my agent up and tell
him. I will. I will call right now. Sean, let's call right now.
It's a very lucky,
but you know,
fun career I've had.
But I feel like it's such not even a lost art, but when you think of Robin and Rick Overton and Greg Proops and you, like, you know, I just think that, it's such a, you guys are, I mean, it's so interesting. You're all like voiced, you know, deities, basically of all these different voices and characters, but just improv geniuses.
I think long, you know,
and I think it's
the top of that pyramid is a guy like Robin, and here's Rick doing, you know, I'm Dying Up There, and he did, what is that one film where the comedic actors gave them all straight roles? Something produced by George Clooney. It escapes my memory at the point. Greg, what is it?
The Informant?
I think it is, yeah.
Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you, Sean. And Greg, when we were in college, was acting, and he was a fine actor. He was a fine actor. We did a British play, The Homecoming, together, and he really had one of the best British dialects I ever heard. he and I saw the play together later in London. We just looked at each other going, man, I'm surprised they didn't just take us out and kill us. What were we doing? You know, you realize, you see really somebody good do it, you're like, oh my God, we missed everything. We missed this entire play. How did that happen? Because you're, you know, students.
Right. Yeah. 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 Well, I mean, so what do you hope for now? What do you want to do?
Right now I start rehearsals tomorrow for Cat on a Hot Tin Roof.
No, I've heard of that.
Yeah. With the Antillas Theater Company here, which is, a pretty big one. And, we've got like 50 of us, and we double cast, and we've got Tony award winning actors in it, Tony nominated actors. And a lot of people you've seen on TV and film and Emmy nominated people. And it's just this large company of theater actors who live in L.A.
Right.
And it's got a great reputation. And we just moved into a new theater in Glendale.
Wow.
And so we're opening a theater with this production. I'm playing Big Daddy along with an actor named Harry Gruner, who's
I knew you would be Big Daddy. I didn't want to say.
Well, I could have been.
I didn't think you would be Brick. Sorry to say I didn't think you'd be Brick.
But I've got the tits for Big Mama. That's the thing. You know, I mean, I've got the accordion decolletage. You just give me a fan and a mint julep.
So, no, wait. Tell me about your drinking years. Is there some freaky shit we need to hear? Because happy hour is for some freaky shit.
No.
Were there drinking drug years? What happened?
Yeah, I mean, no, I'm still an advocate for cannabis, and I enjoy that.
Right.
I just wasn't.
You got a nod from Sean, yeah.
Yeah, I just, you know what? I end up taking a, generally speaking, I took a communal pursuit and turned it into an isolated act.
Oh.
And
what?
When that occurs with
what
any sort of pleasure.
What? Oh, I got it.
What?
Any sort of pleasure. In
oh,
life,
okay, got it.
Then you have to question why you want to be doing it.
Yeah.
Because the idea of all these things is kind of, as a sharing and a
right,
obviously,
because we've had so many comedians here that are like, "Oh, I don't drink anymore," because you know, I mean, I think that there's a common thing that road comedians went like so far with drinking that then they were into this drug and that drug, and what if they just had to stop everything?
Yeah, I mean, I have amusing drug stories, but they're from like the 70s and the 80s.
That's fine,
you know, and
tell us one. Tell us one,
let's
Uncle.
See, do you want me to?
Yes.
Really? Okay, I was in the Army, and I was stationed in Fort Knox, Kentucky, and I was a fuck-up, and I was an entertainment specialist. And what I did is I used to book the NCO clubs for acts, and I cleaned the NCO club. It was a great gig. It was an actual job, 03 Bravo 20, the entertainment specialist. But I was always such a fuck-up, and I got busted during the 4th of July. I stayed in the barracks, me and three other guys, and we got really high. And we were drinking and smoking joints and throwing cherry bombs out the window. And an MP car pulled up. We had the music so loud we couldn't hear the guy on the horn going, "Turn the fucking music down." And right as he did that, somebody chucked an M80 out the window, which went right into their windshield vent, shattered their window.
Oh, dear.
They came up. Fortunately, somebody in the first floor ran up going, "MPs are coming up." And so we got rid of all the dope that we thought we had.
Right.
And he literally kicked the door open. They went, "Freeze." And we all did, like comically, like the Furry Freak Brothers. We're all doing, wing,
bing, bing.
You know? And they're like, "All right, you swinging dicks, you know, where's your fucking CO and all that kind of stuff." And we're like, "Well, he's going to come any second now." Yeah. And they're looking around and they don't have anything. We don't have anything. So we're kind of like being chuckle butts. And then all of a sudden, this one guy looks and he goes, "What do we have here?" And we missed a joint. There's a joint on the bed,
shit.
And we're like, "Oh man," you know. And our the top sergeant had a case of the ass for us, anyways.
It was case of the ass.
That's a great military term. I love it. You know, I almost got some ass for you, son. I got a case of the ass.
I got a case of the ass.
So they call them, and we're like, "Oh shit!" And they're coming. Also, the two MPs relax because now they got something to do, right? You know, they got work, and we're like, you know, and I was sort of like the dorky. I was Flounder in Animal House, you know. So I was like, "Golly, what do we do now?" And, you know, and this one guy looked at me. His name was Eric Maybe. His last name was M-A-Y-B-E, which was much murder. Maybe, yeah. And he looked at me and did the, like, you know, his eyes went, looked at the joint, looked at me and went, you know, jerked his head like, "Eat it." Because I was right next to it. And I'm like,
"Eat it?"
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And all of a sudden he goes, "Hey, Sarge." And he takes the guy's attention. I just ballsed up and went snag, and I put it in my mouth. And, of course, I'm scared, so my mouth's dry, and I'm jammed this into my mouth, and I'm like, you know, like a dog with the peanut butter, you know. "I love you, Bob."
I got it.
I get it down, and we're chilling for a bit, and then the MP's like talking to us, and he goes, "All right, goddammit, you sons of bitches, where is it?" And we're like, "What?
I don't know.
All right, get up. Take your pants off."
Yeah, I don't know.
Now he makes us take our pants off, and he's going to start to do that.
Oh, shit.
And all of a sudden, our CO and the sergeant come up, and our CO, God bless him, he was like this Harvard-educated guy named Cowboy Bob Enyart, and he was a reasonable, decent human being. And he goes, "You know, Sergeant, what are you doing to my men?" And he goes, well, they were smoking pot. And he goes, where's the marijuana at? And he goes, and they had MADs and stuff. He goes, well, yeah, okay. He goes, where's the drugs? He goes, we can't find. He goes, so you have my man's pants down around their ankles and you have no drugs? There was something here and they ate it. Oh, they did. But it's not here now. He goes, no. And he goes, put your pants up, back up, boys. And they, and he like lambasted the MP in front
of us,
which was great, you know, because they're like, oh, you know, because kind of like, oh, great, he's on our side. Of course, they leave and he looks at us and he goes, you sons of bitches, I'll be seeing you tomorrow. And, you know, he chewed us a new asshole.
You're like, oh, shit.
But that, and then I got busted.
And they chewed your asshole and there was still no pot there.
There's still no pot there, exactly. They found the car key. No, you know.
Unless you shit it out by that.
I might have. I'll tell you. So it was like, there's a lot of that fun. A lot of that kind of fun.
Oh, Angel, I'm sorry. It's our food. Okay, I'm sorry. I already paid for it. I already did the thing. Okay. Wow. That's fantastic.
So after a distinguished career.
That's a fantastic story.
After a distinguished career in the military, I mustered out in California.
Wow. And you know, you know what's interesting, Sean? Everyone we've had on that, I just listened to Billy West, my good friend.
Oh.
Who's another, you know, voice guy, improvisational genius. He was on someone else's podcast, and he's talking about like taking separate trips to Peru to get better blow in the 80s. And I'm like,
wow,
everybody has a great fucking drug story.
Yeah.
At some point, I was like, wow, he hasn't told me that. What? Really?
That's the weird thing. I mean, you know, it's like you, it's like, I'm just telling the story, and I keep going. I'm not, you know, the templates are different, the times are different. There's the cars were slower and the sun was more filtered and you could like run between them and not get crushed. And I'm just afraid now that time is rapidly diminishing in this country. It's become.
What are you thinking about the whole Trump thing? How are you feeling?
I just, you know, I don't,
Jesus
I mean.
Jesus fucking Christ.
I feel like Pandora's box got fucking kicked open.
Yeah.
And everything came out and people go, you know, but of course the bottom of the box was hope. And I go, yes, hope is got PTSD because it's just been like, gang bukkake fucked by greed, hatred, misogyny, and they're fucking out now. And it's going to take a while before it gets its feet, gets into therapy, and comes out of that fucking box.
Yeah.
So we can't rely on just hope.
Yeah, anymore. No, you're right. Yeah, hope is fucking fucked now.
Hope needs flowers, cards, and emergency kittens 24 hours a day, you know? And then it'll come out and be fine because you need hope.
We're fucking fucked, man, unless we get the meteor of doom before.
Well, it's interesting because he makes the noises. He says nothing definite. And yet at one point I was listening to him and he goes, you know, Big Pharma, you know, is too much money. They're, you know, they're taking noise. And I went, and my right ear went, I went, oh my God, he just said something I'm interested in. He hasn't done anything, but he does that very well. He's the Lord of Misrule.
Right.
In that sense.
Where you go like, oh, that sounds good. Because I've been grifted before. I've fallen for a grifter. I'm like, oh, that sounds really good. Oh, you mean it'd be better health care for lower premiums and everyone will have it?
So let's strip it all out without a plan coming in and watch these guys walk around the halls. And it's just ridiculous. And I just feel that's it. It's that he says nothing. He is the Wizard of Oz, you know. He's spiritual malt liquor for white people. Dolt 45, you know. That's what I fucking call him.
We can't top that, so we gotta get out now. Dolt 45 is the fucking shit, Michael McShane. How do we follow you on Twitter and support you and do whatever the fuck?
Oh, you know, come to Twitter at this Mike McShane, exactly what it is, and come check out Cat on a Hot Tin Roof. Seriously, it's at www.ntis.org. And if you like to see me do improv, I belong to Impro Theater. We do improvised narrative format. We do a lot of like improvised Chekhov. Improvised Star Trek, a lot of wonderful stuff, and
Robin Williams liked to see him do improv, motherfuckers. So
he gave me some time.
Check it out, man.
Thank you,
Michael
Stephanie.
McShane.
Thank
you.
You are
a pleasure.
Fucking you
and you've gone.
You are Mick Fantastic. You are Mick Wonderful.
And you are you're Millericious.
Love you, Michael McShane. Happy
Love
fucking
you
happy
too,
hour.
Stephanie. Chin, darling. Charlamagne.